Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the question of whether the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States, weaponized a supermarket tabloid, the National Enquirer, to go after his hated enemy, the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, the owner of the newspaper that is Trump's nemesis, the Washington Post. Joining us is Ellie Honig, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York and as the director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey, who is now a legal analyst at CNN, where he has an article, Could AMI's Alleged Action on Bezos Amount to Extortion? We will discuss the extent to which federal law defining the crime of extortion applies in the case now being revisited by the prosecutors in the SDNY, the Southern District of New York, who had previously made a non-prosecution agreement with AMI, the publishers of the National Enquirer, in exchange for evidence they used to convict Trump's lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen. Since Jeff Bezos took the unusual step of going public with charges that he was being blackmailed by AMI, who were threatening to publish further sexually humiliating so-called dick pics of Bezos unless he called off his investigation of them, we'll assess whether a crime has been committed by AMI that would break their non-prosecution agreement with the SDNY and expose them to the same fate as Michael Cohen. Then we'll investigate the Saudi angle to this story and speak with Iyad El-Baghdadi, a writer and human rights activist who was raised in the UAE, then detained without trial and expelled in 2014 for tweeting satirical comments at tyrants in trouble from the Arab Spring. We'll examine the role of former NSA employees who worked for the UAE's Mohammed bin Zayed, the mentor of the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and whether their hacking skills and hacking tools ended up in the hands of the Saudis to be used against Jeff Bezos, who singled out a government entity as the culprit in his explosive blog post, which also hinted at Saudi Arabia having a role. Then finally, with President Trump visiting El Paso on Monday after making wildly inaccurate claims in his State of the Union that the city with one of the country's lowest crime rates was ravaged by crime until a wall was built to keep Mexicans out, we will go to El Paso and speak with Michelle Garcia, a journalist and author who has a recent three-part essay on the U.S.-Mexico border at The Baffler. She joins us to discuss her article, Beto at the Border, and the demonstrations accompanying Congressman Beto O'Rourke's March for Truth planned against Trump's campaign rally in El Paso for his border wall. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ellie Honig, who is served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as a director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He is currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, Could AMI's Alleged Actions on Bezos Amount to Extortion? Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellie Honig.
Thanks for having me.
And as a federal prosecutor, you have prosecuted mafia figures for extortion. Some of them, I take it, handed you a pretty easy case by saying on intercepts that they're going to break somebody's or cut somebody's fingers off unless they pay up. That's extortion in its rawest form. But my sense here is that there's a subtext to this whole Jeff Bezos AMI story that might involve the fact that the world's most powerful man, the President of the United States, has weaponized a supermarket tabloid to go after the world's richest man. Do you think that's the subtext here?
It certainly could be lurking in the background. I think that's the next level of question that we're going to be looking at. What, if any, are the political implications of AMI's threat to Jeff Bezos? Is the president lurking in the background? Are his handlers lurking in the background? There certainly is a long history of a relationship there. I mean, look no further than the hush money payments that were made to Karen McDougal, right? AMI coordinated by the Department of Justice's account, AMI, which is the parent company of the Inquirer, coordinated with Donald Trump and Michael Cohen at the time to make these payments to catch and kill Karen McDougal's story, to purchase the rights to it and then never run it, to make sure it never saw the light of the day. So we do know there's a relationship there. Now, it's not been shown or proven or reported yet in a conclusive way that the president was behind this. But I do think there's another interesting related question that you alluded to, which is, would this be extortion? And as you said, I sort of grew up as a prosecutor doing your traditional mafia cases, not too dissimilar from the hypothetical you gave. I did one trial where the defendant had threatened to cut off someone's fingers unless they paid him every week. This is a little different. It's more complex and it's closer to the line, but I think it still would qualify as something I would have charged if I was still sitting in the prosecutor's chair.
And in your article, Elihanig, you write that federal law defines the crime of extortion as, one, obtaining property from another or attempting to do so, and two, by wrongful use of actual or threatened force, violence, or fear. So the latter, fear, seems to be at play here.
Yeah, there's no question to me. So to break that down, first of all, is AMI trying to get property or a thing of value? Now, it's not your traditional extortion where most of the time someone's demanding money. But I would feel very comfortable arguing that what AMI was trying to get from Jeffrey Bezos, this statement that AMI was not political and had done nothing wrong, is worth a huge amount of value. I mean, that would have a tremendous value to AMI. It's almost, you can't put a sum on it. So I think you're easily going to satisfy that piece of the crime. Was there fear used? Absolutely. This is fear of humiliation, fear of publicly outing these photos, and look no further than AMI's sort of lurid description of the photos in the email they sent to Bezos, where they said, here are the photos we have of you. There's one of you, and I'm paraphrasing, but sort of giving details of how embarrassing they would be. The question, the toughest question for me is that use of fear wrongful? You are allowed to use fear tactics when you're engaged in hard-knuckled business negotiations or legal negotiations. That's what happens in boardrooms and in deposition rooms. But the question is, does it cross over the line to be what the law calls wrongful? Now, there's no mathematical formula for what's wrongful. This largely comes down to just what you could convince a jury of. And I would feel more than comfortable arguing to a jury that threatening to expose nude selfies and lewd photos and trying to force someone to give a false statement as the payoff, I think is wrongful. I think that crosses the line of what we would accept as your normal business or legal practice.
And again, I'm speaking with Elihanig, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. And he's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, Could AMI's Alleged Actions on Bezos Amount to Extortion? Well, just to go back to President Trump, there was no question that President Trump was gloating when the news appeared that Jeff Bezos was getting a divorce. And Trump wrote, so sorry to hear the news about Jeff Bezos being taken down by a competitor whose reporting, I understand, is far more accurate than the reporting of his lobbyist newspaper, the Amazon Washington Post. Hopefully the paper will soon be placed in better and more responsible hands. So he's exposing his hatred for both Bezos and the Washington Post. And Bezos announced his divorce the day before the National Enquirer came out with the first incriminating pictures, or embarrassing pictures, I guess is a better way to put it. So what kind of a heads up do you think Bezos had there?
So I think that's a really interesting and potentially important piece of evidence right there. It shows you motivation, and it shows relationship. It shows you Trump's, again, ongoing relationship with the Inquirer, with AMI, and it shows you his antagonistic relationship towards Bezos and the Post. And you can start to see the political links and motivations come into focus here. Look, it's no secret. Donald Trump has explicitly said it. He said it in the tweet you just read. He hates the Washington Post. And the National Enquirer has long been sort of seen as a tool for him, and he has relationships with the National Enquirer. It's not as if this is some arm's-length media relationship where that particular outlet just happens to like Donald Trump. They deal together. They do business together. And I'm talking about the McDougal hush payments. So if I'm looking at this from a prosecutorial or an investigative standpoint, I think that tweet is enormously important. And it's yet another example of Trump just sort of blurting out something by Twitter that I think rationally is potentially incriminating, or at a minimum, politically problematic for him.
Well, we're told that Donald Trump doesn't really have any friends. His friend Keith Schiller, his bodyguard, was forced out of the White House, and apparently he's been on a fairly lucrative pension from the Republican National Committee ever since. But it's often said that David Pecker, the head of AMI, the publisher of the National Enquirer, is a friend of Trump's. So do we know anything about that, given the overriding question of this is a man with few friends? So if Pecker is designated as a friend, is that incriminating?
Sure. You would want to establish that relationship between these two. If you're going to make an argument that A, this is extortion, and B, that Trump is somehow connected to it, you need to establish a relationship. If they're friends, sure, that goes right to it. And I think it hits particularly hard if you can establish that this is a person with very few friends. I don't know if that's exactly true. I don't know. I mean, the term friend is subjective, and I think Trump and his family would tell you he has a million friends. But if you can establish that someone was part of a closed inner circle, then that could help a case, sure.
Well, we just learned from a leak from somebody fairly senior in the White House to Axios of the president's daily schedule, and it's about at least 6 hours a day watching television, calling his friends, to use the word again, friends. And the implications from that leak is that, and from earlier reporting, is that the president does vent a lot to his friends. So it does seem that his mind is often in that kind of world of tabloid vengeance and celebrity. I mean, you recall years ago, he would pose as a flack, as a PR person, promoting himself in the third person. So he does seem to sort of be comfortable in that kind of world of yellow journalism.
Yeah, there's no question. Look, there's no question he is an avid consumer of media. There's no question he watches Fox News and CNN and MSNBC. He said that many times. He recognizes the reporters. He singles them out. And so he's interested in this world. I think if I was advising him, I would tell him, try to stay above it a little bit. Right? You don't need to necessarily be watching hours a day and tweeting out responses and retweeting things that Fox News said. I'm a little skeptical of that 60% executive time thing. I mean, I know that's what the reporting is, and I know the documents support it. I don't know. There's been a spin on that well, he's just sitting around eating popcorn, watching TV all day. I mean, look, presidents do need time to take care of their own thing. So I don't love that spin on that story. But I do agree, look, he's an avid consumer of media, of social media, and he's always been interested, both when he was a subject of it. He was masterful at, before he ever entered politics, at manipulating the New York tabloids, and then showed a real keen eye for media with The Apprentice. Not that it's the highest brow show, but it certainly drew a lot of attention to him. So he is both a really sort of avid consumer of media, but also an adept manipulator of media, too.
Well, let's move away then from the National Enquirer and supermarket tabloids into what seems to be the meat in this case, or this potential case, which you've written about at CNN, Eli Honig, could AMI's alleged actions on Bezos amount to extortion? This is all to do with the Michael Cohen case, is it not? Michael Cohen is going to jail because he was convicted largely on the testimony, or at least the AMI and Pecker helped, even though they were culpable and co-conspirators, if you will, in these payments and cover-ups of Trump's alleged relationship with a Playmate model, and also before that a porn star. They AMI apparently got a deal from the judge in exchange for their testimony that they would behave well for 3 years, not break any laws, and basically get off scot-free while Michael Cohen goes to jail. Is that a rough description of the legal case?
You mostly got it. I'll make a couple of slight corrections. AMI and David Pecker are walking down a very dangerous road here. They were implicated in the hush money payments to Karen McDougal. Now, some people have said, well, why is that a crime? Here's why it's a crime. Because if those payments were made in order to influence the election, and they were made right before the election, then they are campaign contributions, and in which case, A, they'd be way over the limit, and B, they were never reported. That's what Michael Cohen pled guilty to. And Pecker and AMI entered into a non-prosecution agreement with the Southern District of New York. Judge didn't have anything to do with it. But the prosecutor's office that I used to work at, the Southern District of New York, made a deal, a written deal, with AMI and Pecker saying, if you provide us information, whatever information we ask for, then you'll not be prosecuted for your involvement in the campaign finance violations, in the hush money payments. And it's pretty clear they were involved in it in a criminal way. So they got a free pass on that in exchange for information. But one of the main things that a cooperation or a non-prosecution agreement says is you shall not commit any new crimes. And so if they've committed a new crime here, and it could be extortion, but it also could be separate and apart from what they did with those emails, with those photos, if they used them extortionately, they might have acquired those emails in a criminal way. They might have acquired those emails through hacking, through bribery. We don't know. So if they committed a new crime, then not only are they liable for that new crime, but now they're on the hook and can get charged for their involvement in the hush money payments and the campaign finance violations. So, like I said, they're going down a really dangerous road now.
Well, obviously, Jeff Bezos took a calculation that he's prepared to face further humiliation, and he said, we'll just lift up this rock and see what rolls out. And the fact that he did that blog post on Medium seems to be really what's it's the reason why I guess we're talking, Eli Honig. But don't you think that when Bezos refers to Pecker being apoplectic and really wanting the investigation by the private investigator that Jeff Bezos had hired to end, the implication, at least to my mind, is that what Bezos is saying or reporting or recounting that Pecker is apoplectic is that Pecker is concerned that his activities now exposed or have since been exposed by Jeff Bezos could break that non-prosecution deal and subject him to the same kind of punishment that Michael Cohen is facing.
Sure. I think that absolutely could be what's motivating Pecker, if in fact Pecker was apoplectic. I mean, look, nobody wants to ever be investigated by anybody for anything. So I think we can start with that. But sure, it seems like Pecker was quite freaked out. And the big wild card here, the big unknown that sort of changed everything, was Bezos making the decision to just come out and go public with all of this. It seems pretty clear that AMI and Pecker never expected him to do that. And he made a bold decision to do so, and I think it's really smart. It sort of turned the tables on AMI. I mean, what Bezos did is a personal issue and embarrassing for him, and obviously ruined his marriage. But what AMI and Pecker did gets into issues of criminality and issues of potentially serious political foul play.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Eli Honig, since you served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years, and the Southern District of New York, as you said, made this non-prosecution deal with AMI, and now they're looking at it, we're told. Is that your understanding, that they're looking
sure,
at this deal?
Yeah, I mean, that's been reported. That's exactly what I would do here. If I had a non-prosecution agreement with a party, with a person, with a corporation, and then I got information that they may have committed a crime while under that agreement, yeah, absolutely. That's a big deal to a prosecutor. Look, once you sign someone up as a prosecutor, as a cooperator, or give them a non-pros, they're essentially on your dime now. Anything that they do reflects on you as a prosecutor and your office. And so prosecutors are quite sensitive and take quite seriously the possibility that any cooperator or someone who got a non-pros agreement would go and commit a crime while on the prosecutor's watch. So, sure, the Southern District is absolutely must be digging into this right now, and they should probably make a determination fairly soon if they're going to end that cooperation agreement, that non-prosecution agreement, in which case AMI's got a lot of trouble.
And specifically, it means that, what, they're essentially, the deal's off, so therefore they're equally culpable as Michael Cohen?
Yeah, it means the deal's off. They're no longer protected on the hush money payments, and they can be charged just like anybody else can be charged with that. And so the question would be, does the Southern District have enough evidence to charge Pecker and AMI with the hush money payments? It seems clear to me that they do. I mean, they had enough that Michael Cohen pled guilty to it. They lay out a lot of details. They seem to have chapter and verse on who made those payments, who authorized those payments, who was behind them. And Pecker and AMI were central. They were the vehicle through which the payments were made to purchase and kill Vasori. And so if those payments were made in order to silence somebody, to protect a candidate in an election, then you have a campaign finance violation. So, yeah, I would surmise that Southern District has a pretty strong case against Pecker and AMI on the campaign finance.
Well, it was reported that the Southern District got access to the safe where the crown jewels of the National Enquirer's business model, which appears to be pretty close to blackmail.
I'd love to see what's in that safe. My prosecutorial instincts are kicking in. I'm thinking, oh boy, I'd love to see that. I mean, look, presumably it's the most interesting sort of high level stuff. So they have it.
Well, just a last thought, though, just to broaden it out a little bit. I'm sure, as a former prosecutor, you must have been pretty appalled, as most people were, by the testimony from the acting attorney general, Whitaker, last Friday. And on top of that, we've got a new attorney general coming in, Barr, who didn't really promise that we'd all see or hear from the Mueller report without some kind of redaction by the Department of Justice. There was no clear assurances. In fact, it's prompted a bipartisan group, two senators, a Democrat and a Republican chair of the Judiciary Committee, to put forth a law to protect whatever comes out of the Mueller report and make sure it's transparent. So we don't have real assurances from Barr. But if Barr is, as he indicated in his unsolicited 19-page memo, sympathetic to executive power and skeptical of the Mueller inquiry, my understanding is that the Southern District of New York would be much more vulnerable to a new attorney general, perhaps more so than Mueller in terms of the new attorney general's attitude to basically protecting the executive branch.
Well, I think the Southern District is less vulnerable to a new AG than Mueller is, for a couple of reasons. So, first of all, Mueller, he could be fired, right? And if Mueller gets fired, I think there's a huge political problem. But if he gets fired, the special counsel investigation largely goes away. You can't fire the Southern District of New York as the president. Maybe you can fire the U.S. attorney, a great political peril, but that office still will have 150 eager prosecutors that will carry on. Robert Mueller can be defunded. This was one of the ideas Matthew Whitaker floated out there when he was auditioning for AG. You cannot defund the Southern District of New York. Robert Mueller is constrained in what he is permitted to look at. His commission says, you are appointed to investigate Russian election interference and matters arising directly from that. The Southern District can investigate whatever they want, wherever the evidence leads. Trump org, finances, campaign finance payments, all of that stuff. Mueller is under time pressure to wrap up. Right? Again, Whitaker, I think, wildly irresponsibly sort of blurted out, not in his testimony, but a week before that, that Mueller was close to being completed. And there's clearly political pressure on Mueller to wrap up within a certain time frame. Southern District can take whatever time it needs. But most importantly, Robert Mueller operates under a specific set of special counsel regulations. These are on the books. And he has to run certain investigative, it says any significant investigative or prosecutorial decision has to run through the attorney general. Now, it's been Rod Rosenstein up until now, and it's unclear what Whitaker's role is, but clearly that's going to be Barr when Barr takes over. I think he should probably recuse himself because of the writings that you mentioned before, but I don't think he will. If Whitaker didn't, Barr won't. So the point is, Mueller has to run his major decisions through William Barr, including his report. The Southern District does not, by regulation or statute, have to run every investigative or prosecutorial decision through Barr. Sure, the Southern District is still part of the United States Department of Justice. Sure, there are certain things that have to be run up to the Attorney General's office, but it is not nearly as broad as what Mueller has to run through Barr, which is any significant investigative or prosecutorial step. So if I'm Trump and the people around him, in some ways I'm more afraid of what the Southern District is going to do than Mueller.
Well, Eli Honig, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Eli Honig, who served as an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York for 8 years and as director of the Division of Criminal Justice at the Office of the Attorney General of the State of New Jersey for 5 years. He's currently executive director at Rutgers Institute for Secure Communities and a legal analyst for CNN, where he has an op-ed, Could AMI's Alleged Actions on Bezos Amount to Extortion? We're going to take a B-Station break and back investigating the Saudi angle to the Bezos AMI story. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Iyad El-Baghdadi, a writer and human rights activist who became prominent for tweeting and commenting on the Arab Spring. He became well known for the Arab Tyrants Manual, a collection of satirical tweets poking fun at tyrants in trouble. And Iyad is a stateless Palestinian born and raised in the UAE. And in the spring of 2014, he was detained without trial and expelled from the UAE without explanation or process for appeal. And he's currently working on the Arab Spring Manifesto, a two-volume book on a vision for the future of the post-Arab Spring Arab world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Iyad El-Baghdadi.
Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And since you have been a victim, if you will, of the repressive nature of the government in the UAE, particularly MBZ, as he's called, who's a very much, we're told, something like a mentor for MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the soon-to-be Saudi king, currently crown prince. This Jeff Bezos blog post, which has been quite explosive here in the U.S. press and probably around the world, I imagine, indicates that the private security firm that Bezos hired to look into how AMI were able to hack into his phone, or somebody was able to hack into his phone. AMI published the contents of the hack, which caused him to divorce his wife and face even further humiliation in what seemed like an extortion attempt. And then he took the bold move of going public. But his security person that he hired to look into AMI's activities, Gavin De Becker, said a government entity was involved. And there's a great deal of suspicion that that government entity might either be Saudi Arabia, probably would be Saudi Arabia, since Saudi Arabia featured so much in the blog post. Bezos himself suggested that link. So what is the connection? Let's start with that. We know that the UAE hired over a dozen former NSA officers in something was called Project Raven to essentially use NSA hacking tools against the people of the UAEs, particularly those dissidents like yourself. So let's begin there with Project Raven.
Well, the United Arab Emirates has been interested in cyber warfare and being able to snoop on the electronic communication of people who it considers to be its rivals, I would say since 2010. Interestingly, 2010 is also when Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, set up shop in the United Arab Emirates. It happened within a few months of each other. So they developed this, they were interested in this even before the Arab Spring started. And I think when the Arab Spring began in 2011, it was all the more reason for them to invest into their, cyber warfare, both defensive and offensive activities. Now, I think you're referencing the recent report by Reuters which basically it uncovered this project that has actually been going on, I think, since 2014. What's really explosive in this story is that not only did the UAE hire ex-NSA officials and operatives, but also that they, on several occasions, spied on other Americans. However, everything to do with the Raven story, as far as I know, concerns activities. I mean, the part that we know about is things that happened up to 2016. So if there's anything happening now, it might be years before we actually find out exactly what they're up to.
Well, briefly, just for our audience to sort of catch up, in 2014, Laurie Stroud, who worked for the NSA in Hawaii, she brought Edward Snowden onto her team shortly before he went to Hong Kong and then on to Russia with just thousands and thousands of documents, 95% of which, according to the Oversight Intelligence Committees in the House and Senate, say were unrelated to U.S. civil liberties, but were rather important American secrets. Laurie Stroud, obviously, having hired Snowden, was not particularly popular with the NSA. So she took this job in 2014 in the UAE, along with about a dozen other former NSA people, and they were basically using We don't know what kind of tools, hacking tools, they took with them, but they certainly took a lot of intellectual property, for the want of a better description, and that was used against dissidents like yourself and also targeted Americans. What's important about this is that when Laurie Stroud returned from the UAE, the FBI immediately interviewed her, and they're still investigating the extent to which perhaps NSA tools were used. So that's, as far as I know, where the story is. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, your description is very, very accurate. The fact here is that, as you mentioned before, MBZ, who is the Mohammed bin Zayed, he's the crown prince, the de facto ruler of the United Arab Emirates, has a very interesting relationship with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, who is the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. In fact, it's almost kind of a mentorship relationship and might actually be deeper. And it's also a very strong strategic alliance between the two countries. So it is almost certain that if the UAE has cyber warfare capabilities, it would share them with the Saudis. It would share these capacities with the Saudis and vice versa. Now, on this particular incident, we still don't know how they came into possession of Jeff Bezos's private communications. We don't know whether it was actually the result of a hack or whether someone was paid off and, you know, leaked it. It's not clear yet, but, you know, the political motivations are there. I mean, as for me myself, as an expert who looks at these things, I think it's very clear that the Saudi connection, the Saudi angle, is really a productive angle here, and I think more people should be probing into it.
Well, there is a possibility that the girlfriend of Jeff Bezos' brother, apparently he's close to Roger Stone, and he may well have had access to her phone, but that still wouldn't be sufficient, I don't think, to be able to hack into. It would certainly be the gateway to hack into Jeff Bezos' phone, and one would assume that the head of the richest man in the world, the head of the world's most powerful company, which has massive contracts with both the NSA and the CIA, you'd think that he would have pretty sophisticated electronic devices. But, you know, one doesn't know. But there's another link here that's interesting, Iyad al-Baghdadi, and that is that in 2017, the Israeli firm NSO Group sold Mohammed bin Salman a $55 million spy program called Pegasus, which hacks into smartphones to obtain their contents. And apparently, MBS used them to spy on Jamal Khashoggi. So that's another possibility, is it not, that the Saudis could have got sophisticated hacking tools from the Israelis. We've been discussing the extent to which it may have come from the NSA people that work for the UAE.
Well, there's definitely a possibility as well, of course. And note, of course, importantly, how they managed to snoop on Jamal Khashoggi's communications. They didn't have access to Jamal's phone, but they had access to another activist, Omar Abdelaziz, who lives in Canada. They managed to hack Omar's phone, and he was in frequent communication with Jamal. So the idea here is that maybe they didn't hack Jeff Bezos' phone. Maybe it's his girlfriend's phone that got hacked. Mm-hmm. We don't know. And the thing is, even with the Israeli story, with the Israeli, the NSA, the Pegasus story, this happened in 2017, as we mentioned, and we came to know about it because of, people started looking into it after Jamal's brutal murder last year. So we don't know what other capacities they might have that we simply don't know about.
Well, it is pretty clear that there is a Saudi connection. I don't think Jeff Bezos would have mentioned it unless he had some evidence. And we know that AMI printed this glossy Valentine to MBS when he was visiting the United States. It's 100-page, no advertising, so therefore somebody covered the costs, but it just comprised of pictures of Mohammed bin Salman and a cover, and was basically just, I can't remember the name of it, but it was basically saying, you know, this is the coming of the new kingdom of the liberal democracy and all of this nonsense, which, of course, was a part of the massive public relations campaign that Mohammed bin Salman engaged in, which conned a lot of Western journalists, including Thomas Friedman of the New York Times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think it's also important to note that David Pecker's relationship with the Saudi royalty go back to a year before. So there is a timeline that we can draw from almost July, I believe, 2017, all the way to March 2018. March is when the mystery magazine that you mentioned, you know, appeared on the newsstands. There was an ongoing relationship there, and I believe there was an Associated Press report in April 2018, which uncovered the fact that Saudi officials were made aware of the publication almost a month before it appeared. They were sent the digital copies of it. They went through it, and they even forwarded to some of their contacts in D.C. So they were definitely aware of the of this publication. The point about this publication, why it matters here, is that if AMI received money or any kind of direction or any kind of compensation, really, if anything of value, really, as a result, if there was some kind of agreement between AMI and the Saudis to create this publication, then AMI would have acted as a foreign agent, as an agent of a foreign power. So it would have violated certain laws when it comes to registering as a foreign agent, which of course they didn't, and they still maintain that there was no connection. The Saudis say, the Saudis and AMI kind of present the same story, which is AMI just happened to do it because it wanted to somehow.
Well, we know that Donald Trump doesn't have any friends except for his bodyguard, Keith Schiller, who no longer works at the White House but is being paid handsomely by the Republican National Committee. And the other friend that we've been told is David Pecker. So we know that Donald Trump celebrated the divorce of Jeff Bezos, and he announced his divorce just the day before the National Enquirer dumped all of these incriminating, embarrassing pictures. They've held back on the apparently the most salacious ones, and that's what they were essentially blackmailing Bezos with, and he flipped the switch on them by going public, and now they're in legal trouble. So we know that Trump hates Bezos, hates the Washington Post. We also know that the Saudis, MBS, hates the Washington Post. They were the employees of Jamal Khashoggi. And the Washington Post has been doing really serious investigations and keeping the story alive, because the president is doing everything he can to sweep it under the rug. He's the only person on the planet who appears not to believe that MBS was behind the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. And to my mind, I'm absolutely convinced that there's a huge payoff here. Trump is totally transactional, and we know that. And if he's sticking his neck out for MBS in the way that he is, don't you think he's getting something in return from MBS?
I think the relationship really goes deeper than that. I think when we get to know the entire collusion story, the story is not going to be just Russia, Trump, and that's it. I mean, it won't be just Trump, the Trump campaign, or, you know, people in the Trump campaign in Russia. I think it's a five-party collusion here. It's going to be very clear that Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel were part of the whole ecosystem of collusion. And I think this is going to become very clear as, you know, more information becomes available to us in 2019.
Well, there's no question that the son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has shaken down the Qataris for $500 million for the vanity project that he bought when he was courting Trump's daughter, Ivanka, overpaid for it. It's been underwater. And mysteriously, money has appeared to cover the $1.2 billion that they couldn't pony up with. So, and a lot of world leaders are now being complaining that Jared Kushner basically runs around the world posing as the peacemaker, but in fact he's just extorting governments for money. He started out with the Chinese, and they turned him down. And then he went on December the 10th of 2016. He had a meeting with the Russian ambassador, Kislyak, and the head of the what's called Putin Slush Fund, VNB Bank. And he asked them for $500 million, along with a back channel between the Kremlin and the White House. So the record's pretty clear that it's not just Trump who's involved in perhaps receiving illicit funds from the Saudis, either campaign funds or even campaign funds for 2020. That's not out of the question.
Well, absolutely. I think there's a lot more that's going to be uncovered on the relationship between Kushner and MBS. And I think that's going to be explosive. I think it's going to be quite a big story. However, I'm very cautious about it, mainly because the details are just so explosive that you kind of, it almost takes your breath away. It's almost like you want to slow down and you're like, okay, I want to make sure that what I'm reading here, what's the picture that's coming to my mind right now that's forming in front of me is actually true. So absolutely, it's not just Trump. It's really people around Trump. Like you said, he is transactional and he thinks he looks at the world in, you know, as he doesn't like institutions, obviously. He prefers personal relationships. And that's what dictatorships are. I mean, dictatorships are basically personal networks disguised as institutions. And to be honest, I feel that people like MBS and MBZ would be more comfortable dealing with someone like Trump and, you know, people who are around Trump's orbit. And so I definitely believe that there is a lot more that's going to be uncovered. There is definitely a payback angle here. However, when it comes to the Bezos story specifically, I'm disinclined to think that Trump was directly involved. I think the impetus over here has been the Saudis. Trump is definitely an enabler, but I don't think he was the impetus when it comes to this point, to this you know, most recent crisis specifically.
Well, just in closing, Donald Trump has defied his own intelligence community, who have said unequivocally that MBS was behind the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi. He's defied the Republican-controlled Senate, who passed an overwhelming resolution saying that MBS was behind it. He's now defying the United Nations, who have come up with the same conclusion, that MBS was behind it. So there's no question that Donald Trump is sticking his neck way out for MBS, and MBS is not Saudi Arabia. MBS is just one horrible, corrupt royal of the royal family, as it's called, that has thousands of princes. So he's not indispensable. So something is going on here. Trump does not go to the mat for somebody unless he gets something in return.
And looking at it in reverse as well, Trump is not America. I mean, Trump is not going to be able to defend and to protect MBS from U.S. institutions forever. And this is, I think, the matter which is most interesting for observers such as myself. Where is this relationship going to go after Trump?
Well, Iyad el-Baghdadi, let's leave on that note, and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Iyad el-Baghdadi, who's a writer and human rights activist who became prominent for tweeting and commenting on the Arab Spring. He became well known for the Arab Tyrants Manual, a collection of satirical tweets poking fun at tyrants in trouble. And Iyad is a stateless Palestinian born and raised in the UAE. And in the spring of 2014, he was detained without trial and expelled from the UAE without explanation or process for appeal. He's currently working on the Arab Spring Manifesto, a two-volume book on a vision for the future of the post-Arab Spring Arab world. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the demonstrations accompanying Congressman Beto O'Rourke's March for Truth planned on Monday against Trump's campaign rally in El Paso for his border wall.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Well, Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and current Soros Equality Fellow at the Open Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She's the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. She has a recent three-part essay series on the U.S.-Mexico border at The Baffler. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michelle Garcia.
It's good to be here.
Well, thank you, Michelle. And, of course, the border security talks in the Congress look like they're breaking down. GOP Senator Richard Shelby, in charge of the talks, was pretty pessimistic, saying they were stalled. So we could have a government shutdown on Friday. We could also have a declaration of a national emergency by President Trump. But tomorrow, Monday, the president goes down to El Paso. El Paso, of course, featured in the president's State of the Union, where he made wildly inaccurate claims that the city of El Paso, which has one of the country's lowest crime rates, was ravaged by crime until a wall was built to keep Mexicans out. So there will be a rally, I believe, at the Coliseum in El Paso by Trump on, I think it's on Monday night, but there'll also be a demonstration and a march led by Congressman Beto O'Rourke, the March for Truth, which is planned against what essentially will be a Trump campaign rally. So let's start with the latest news from the bipartisan negotiations to avoid a government shutdown and a declaration of a national emergency. Doesn't look promising, right?
It certainly doesn't. We have to also look at this in the bigger picture. Democrats have been reloading the gun for Republicans in terms of border security going back to the 1990s, which is when a lot of the laws that are being used now were put in place by President Clinton. So the question we need to be asking ourselves right now, because it's so easy to focus on the immediate political moment, right? Today's headlines, this week's headlines, and ask ourselves, what part of this negotiation and discussion about border security is actually kicking the can down the road that will create bigger problems over time? We see that the border wall was first created, one of the first was during the Clinton administration, then during the Obama administration. And with time, you have seen border security, which is deeply entrenched in this country as a justification for violence and unlawful acts by state agents, grow and become increasingly symbolic and politically powerful, culturally powerful in our nation, so much so that our current president could run on it. So when we talk about the discussion, the debate right now, and the compromise, so-called compromise, what is on the table that is actually going to blow up potentially in our faces further down the line? Are you either averting a crisis now, or are you fueling an ongoing crisis that has been, you know, unfolding now for decades?
Well, the president actually makes that charge in a tweet today. Donald Trump said it was a very bad week for the Democrats with the great economic numbers, the Virginia disaster and the State of the Union address. Now, with the terrible offers being made by them to the border committee, I actually believe they want a shutdown. They want a new subject. Now, I don't imagine you agreeing with Donald Trump.
I'm not. The thing is that, again, this is defining the current political moment. There's nothing to say. Remember, his ultimate goal is a huge, very expensive wall. There's nothing to say that if Democrats concede and reload this political weapon for him right now, that sometime further down the road, that it's not going to occur later. I mean, the truth of the matter is that we all know, and it is factual, I mean, those of us still living in the factually grounded world, that the border wall does not do what people claim to do. It doesn't stop the flow of drugs. That comes from ports of entry. We know that. It has pushed migration routes, and most of the migrants now are asylum seekers. So the question should be asking ourselves is, what is the compromise over something that fundamentally doesn't work and that, you know, provides political currency for a party that will then be used in the 2020 election. And let's also keep in mind that Democrats won many seats, including in Texas, by historic turnouts by blacks and Latinos who oppose the border wall. The strongest opposition to border wall, according to the Quinnipiac poll last year, is African-Americans. And by conceding this, what are Democrats going to give up? I'm not interested, and I don't think we are interested, in having a debate within the parameters that are set up by people with short-term political interests when, truthfully, what the American people need and want is leadership.
So, Michelle, if we go back to President George W. Bush's bipartisan efforts at a comprehensive immigration deal, is there, I mean, when you talk about the both parties being culpable, the Democrats and the Republicans, my understanding of the immigration issue is that it sort of crosses ideological lines, in as much as you could argue that there's a de facto alliance between the Chamber of Commerce on the right and MALDEF on the left, and unions on one hand in league with Minuteman. So it doesn't neatly fit into any kind of left-right paradigm, does it?
Well, I think there are people who make a strong argument that Democrats have been complicit in the creation of this border security monster. And by monster, I mean it is so symbolically potent now that it brings the country to its knees. And so what we have is an ongoing conversation about a symbol, not about what really actually functional solutions. There hasn't been comprehensive immigration reform, but there are drones, there are helicopters, there's armed boats in the Rio Grande Valley right now monitoring. There is a new checkpoint about to go up that has new technological abilities that essentially amount to what I think a lot of privacy people, experts are going to be concerned about, which is the ability to penetrate into a person's vehicle. You have documented ongoing massive security apparatus that exists on the border that has been funded by both parties. And so the issue is what are we debating? What are we really debating? The problem is that Trump has expertly turned our attention away from the real border crisis. Last I checked, there were 40 people sitting on the international border in the Rio Grande Valley, and volunteers from the Texas side taking them food, volunteers from Mexico side helping care for them. There are nearly 2,000 asylum seekers that were penned up in an old factory in Piedras Negras across the border from Eagle Pass. There are people who are losing their land in the Rio Grande Valley to the government seizing of their land in order to build this new wall that was funded by the Appropriations Bill 2018 that included votes by some Texas Democrats, including Beto O'Rourke. So the real border crisis right now, the way I see it, are the people who are sitting on the bridge, the people who are being dumped on the streets of El Paso and in the Rio Grande Valley, asylum seekers that then local community groups have to respond to as fellow human beings, the massive privacy issues, the security, the massive government taking of privately owned land in the interest and the name of border security. These are the issues. And as far as Trump going to El Paso, what astonishes me, truly astonishes me, is that the wall construction that was taking place beginning in September, I believe, of last year, was the replacing of existing border barriers. The new border wall, the one that's constructed by Appropriations Bill from 2018, that's happening in the Rio Grande Valley. And for those people who are not as familiar with geography of Texas, I will tell you that it's about the distance of like a over 12-hour drive. So if Donald Trump is so proud of his border wall, the one that he's creating, then why isn't he showing up in the Rio Grande Valley where they're about to bulldoze pristine habitat and show up and say, I built this?
Well, what you're telling us, and it's very important that we hear what you're saying, Michelle Garcia, is that for all of the absurdity of Trump's wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for, real damage is being done by the Me Too Party, the Democrats, who offer compromises. And in offering compromises, they militarize the border and deepen the problem.
I think that, you know, what I'm saying is not that it's about looking at this, pulling back, taking a step back and looking at what is actually being done here. What is actually being discussed? Have Democrats played a role in this? Absolutely. Have Republicans made this their, like I said, their favorite political weapon? And I wrote that in one of my Baffler pieces. Absolutely. The thing, too, also is that we as a nation need to be having a discussion about how it is that a wall could be the fundamental centerpiece for a campaign for presidency, and how that same wall could then have enough political currency that it will shut down this country. That, I think, is the larger question. I mean, in terms of, I think it's not so much about finger pointing in as it is accountability. And so when we're talking about a quote unquote compromise, again, the larger questions are, it's not a compromise means you make a deal, we've reached an understanding. We've seen in the history of so-called border security that this is an ongoing, ever-growing, evolving, expanding apparatus. And so what are we going to see in a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now? What comes next?
Well, the trajectory we've always been on is one of denial about some of the real issues. For example, the war on drugs. We blame Mexico and the cartels, but we here in the United States are the consumers. So we have massive culpability in that regard. And it's pretty clear from the Central American caravans that Trump has demonized and used as a campaign rally and will continue to do so, that if with a fraction of the money they're spending on these border walls, et cetera, and technologies that you mentioned like drones, a fraction of that money, if that was sent to those Central American countries to make life more livable for the people there, would go much, much further towards solving this so-called problem. I mean, the Europeans have solved it. They don't have borders. Borders are, in many ways, a fiction. They don't work. And, you know, I'm not suggesting open borders. That's the canard that Trump uses. But, in effect, you don't really need borders if you have a rational debate and a rational relationship with your neighbor.
Well, that's where we get to the other side of the function of borders, Ian, which is borders are also the site where national identity takes shape, where national identity is formed. I mean, that is part of the function of borders, and that role of borders is what we see acted out and influential in our politics and has been, which is that it's a proxy and a symbol for national identity. So let's take a look at our borders right now and look at it like a mirror and say, that's who we are. And then when you do that, decide whether that is what we want it to be. Because the truth of the matter is the reason the rational debate can't happen is because it is so politically charged with symbolism and notions that have nothing to do with what actually happens on a border. How many reports need to come out about how safe the cities are? Or how many reports need to come out about why asylum seekers are arriving in this country and about the levels of violence and impunity in those countries, some of which the United States has had a role in? How many reports need to come out about that drugs come through ports of entry or about illegal, quote-unquote, illegal immigration? That train left a long time ago. And in regard to drugs, as it so happens, the day before yesterday, the Customs and Border Protection made an announcement of the largest domestic drug seizure in history, 1.7 tons of meth, cocaine, heroin, seized. Where? The port in Long Beach on its way to Australia. This is an export. So the thing is that, yes, there's no, how do we change the conversation? And how do we have an understanding of that this is so emotional for people?
Right.
It's an emotionally potent issue that politicians are able to run on and therefore to distract us. The ultimate issue here is that how the emotional potency of borders can be so much so that it just distracts us from fundamental issues, including the ones that you just described.
Well, Michelle Garcia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Michelle Garcia, who's a journalist, essayist, and current Soros Equity Fellow at the Open Society Foundation, a former Texas correspondent for the Columbia Journalism Review, and a former columnist for the Texas Observer. She's the director of the PBS documentary Against Mexico, The Making of Heroes and Enemies, and is currently working on a book about borders and their powerful influence on U.S. identity, politics, and the culture of violence. And she has a recent three-part essay series on the U.S.-Mexico border at The Baffler. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.